Welcome to Flatten the Curve, a podcast that looks at the impact of the coronavirus on life in Wales. We'll be sharing our thoughts, but more importantly, we'll be hearing from the experts and those whose lives have been most affected and disrupted. Together, we'll unpick our way through the science and try to better understand the weeks and months ahead. From Wuhan to Wales and everything in between, this is the podcast to take on the pandemic. It's the week after Hay Festival, it's the week after Eisteddfod yr Urdd, or Eisteddfod T, which can only mean that there's only one topic on our minds this week. Indeed, it's time to discuss the impact that COVID-19 has had on the arts and culture sectors here in Wales. But before we jump into the world of literature, music, theatre, arts and poetry, we have to discuss your hair, Jack.
I know, it feels like this hair gets more airtime than any other topic on this podcast.
Hair time.
but that's good. But fear not. The clippers have been purchased. I can hear like an applause somewhere. It's time to remove the locks. So I'd imagine you'll all be in a bit of a shock next week for the big reveal. It's a skill I'm not sure I'll be any good at, but I'll give it a go with you.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And talking about skills and talents, I bet you've been loving it over the past week.
I have. We were all worried, weren't we? I mean, all our calendars were emptying up. So I was so pleased that two of our biggest cultural events here in Wales were able to go ahead in some form over the last week. Hay Festival, or Hay on Wi-Fi, yeah, they turned to putting a fantastic digital programme together, and it wouldn't be May without the Eisteddfod yr Urdd and an opportunity for children and young people to share their talents with the world. Eisteddfod T was what it was recalled, a play on the words of T-T-I, meaning your Eisteddfod, but also T-Y, T, house, the house Eisteddfod, which is great, I think. And have you managed to watch any of the activities of the last couple of weeks?
I've not, no, I'm afraid. It's quite sad as well. I've been kind of following it online, kind of avidly looking at all the various tweets from all of the participants and lots of the speakers. There was a really good talk from Rutger Bregman that I really, really wanted to look at, but alas, work and other things got in the way, as they do these days. It seems COVID's taken over my life. but it was nice to kind of follow some of it online, and particularly with the Urdd stuff and the messaging and lots of people sharing that and kind of the message of hope and peace that was being shared was really nice to see. So even though I couldn't be a part of it, I kind of felt the love and the warmth radiating on social media.
Absolutely. And you have the benefit, of course, because they were all digital, they were all recorded, which means you can return to them when things have quietened down here. You can turn to rewatching some of the highlights of the Hay Festival last week. My particular favourite was Mareryd Hopwood, her session on what's Wales in Welsh. We all know that's Cymru, but she went into more detail around what the meaning of the word and what it means to be Welsh today. And she said, being Welsh is not about who was here first. When you call us foreign, we open our hands to welcome you. Wales translates as together land, which I really think is really nice. If you go back into the origins of the word and its translations, together land, that's such a nice way of summing up our country, I think.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. And I think that brings us, you know, nicely on to discussing why the arts and culture are so important and why we've chosen to talk about it today.
Well, yeah, indeed, we are a proud cultural land. The Wellbeing of Future Generations Act places culture at the heart of sustainable development alongside the other pillars that are equally important: economic, social and environmental. Often is the case, isn't it, Hugh, that culture is pushed aside. And I think even under the current circumstances of COVID-19, culture hasn't really been something that we've discussed. The impact on the industries, the people who work in them. There's been concerns that the West End even and the theatre industry may never quite recover. And the same for some of our most iconic museums, be those small ones or even the larger ones across the UK.
Yeah, it really is a scary time for a lot of people out there. And, you know, in a former life, during my time in London, I myself was a performer, theatre director and producer. And I can't help but think now, looking at kind of friends' posts on social media, how terrifying it would be. And I'm kind of, you know, grateful that I'm not in that position now, but also feeling terribly bad for them because, you know, there are people struggling out there. They're not getting the support that they need. And, you know, this is risking their life, their livelihood. And more so than that, it's putting at risk something they really care and are really passionate about. You know, people are working in the arts, it's a passion, it's a job of passion about love. It's, and they love what they're doing, and they're not able to do that at the moment, or they're having to do it in different ways that mean they can't make as much of a living from it, which is, you know, it's really worrying. And I think the impacts will be felt for a long time, but hopefully with the right support, using the right levers like the Future Generations Act, hopefully we can rebuild and build back better, as they are saying now. So, you know, I think there is hope there for the sector, and I hope just people can endure, pull through, and maybe create some beautiful art from it.
Absolutely. And I think there are glimpses of positivity even in these dark times as we enter, I think, into our 12th or 13th week of lockdown. Of course, there are always talks of lifting restrictions, and fingers crossed on that one. But even, you know, as close as where I live now, I can more or less see from where I live the Wales Millennium Centre. And I'm told that they decided in the Wales Millennium Centre not to furlough their young people. And actually, they're getting to understand and appreciate even more so the work that they're doing within the centre. And they're still creating cultural content, be that through podcasts and vlogs and other things as well. So I think it's really important for us to understand in this time of need, of darkness that we are in, that there are some positivity messages and activities happening out there. What else have you seen here? What else is out there that's in the culture and the art scene that's been keeping you active over the last couple of weeks?
I'm an avid kind of follower of different comedians, and it's been quite nice to see the work that they've been doing. Particular comedians that I follow around, kind of, you know, talking about mental health and being able to do it in a really accessible way, because art and culture, it does let you talk about these harder topics, these difficult to understand topics, these really, you know, big concepts in a very accessible way. And it's nice that people are able to access support through arts and culture and understand feelings through whatever creative endeavors they're pursuing. You know, we've just done a bit of work on this with the How Are You Doing campaign at Public Health Wales. We're looking at how people can engage with creative processes, with whether it's drawing, coloring, baking, cake decorating, or whatever, just trying to find creative ways of relaxing and maybe recognizing some of their emotions through this kind of arts and culture. And, you know, again, it's why it's so important, and hopefully, you know, it's what people's going to help people get through.
Yeah, but I do hope that there's more that government here in Wales, but also across the UK in local government as well, to understand the role of culture, you know, and what more we can do post COVID to value it more, because a lot of people at the moment are not accessing it, can't access it, may not have the benefit of strong broadband or connectivity in their homes, enjoy things like the National Theatre Live or the Andrew Lloyd Webber's musicals that have been appearing on YouTube that he's been putting up. And I think it's really important that we find ways of ensuring that everyone has access to culture. And maybe this has given us a time to rethink about that.
Absolutely. I think, you know, culture creates a sense of belonging, and belonging has a massive impact on your health and well-being. It creates a sense of place, a sense of belonging. And if you don't feel a part of something, you don't kind of access that wider network of support that could be available offline or through various networks. Hopefully we do see some stronger commitments to culture going forward. And speaking of going forward, at the time of recording, we are waiting on a review of the restrictions in Wales, which we'll hopefully be discussing next week. Hopefully we'll see some new freedoms, but hopefully people will take them on board sensibly and not rush out too quickly, as we've seen across the border.
There we go. Advice from our very own Public Health Wales expert ahead of those restrictions. So we'll discuss those on the podcast in the coming weeks. We've got lots of different themes that we still need to cover, delving into some more of the inequalities around COVID-19, our recent episode on the BAME community, but we've got other areas across Wales that we need to discuss as well. So make sure you tune in.
This week, we're joined by not one, but two fantastic guests who will help us delve into the finer details of the impact of coronavirus on arts and culture here in Wales.
Yes, our first guest is broadcaster Hugh Thomas. Although you'd usually find Hugh talking about arts and culture here in Wales, he's now found himself covering health as part of the wave of coverage surrounding the COVID-19 crisis. Croeso, Hugh.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. And it'll certainly be interesting to get your of insight on kind of the change over there as well. We're also joined by Phil George, Chair of the Arts Council of Wales. I hope you've not also had to change roles there, Phil. Let's certainly leave a big kind of gap in the market there, but I'm sure there's certainly some crossover points that we can pick up on later. So welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's very good to join you. I'm a former broadcaster, of course, so happy to join this distinguished company.
We all have that in common. That's a good way to start the podcast. Hugh, let's start with you. First of all, how are you? Tell us a bit more about yourself and what you do and you know, how life has changed for you over the last few months.
Yeah, quite a big change on the work front. I mean, having spent 7.5 years covering arts and media stories for BBC Wales, when all of this kicked off, myself and a couple of colleagues were all brought to work together on health stories. So in terms of my work, the focus has been on the health side of things, and it's obviously been really busy. I haven't really done any arts and media stories during the course of the pandemic. I mean, plenty of them have been coming in, and we've been trying to make sure that they are still covered by other reporters, other parts of the operation. But yeah, my focus has been on telling the story of coronavirus more than anything else.
And back at home, how have you made sure that you switch off? And it's one thing I remember from the days of being a journalist, very hard to do so. The first thing I often did when I came home from working at the BBC was switch on the news again and start absorbing the world around this.
You can't help it. Well, that's the thing. I mean, you're so sort of ingrained in it all day. You kind of want to get home and see what everyone else is doing about the same story that you've just spent the last 12 hours working on. I mean, consuming news and I think news night as well is probably one of the biggest sort of signposts for me in terms of looking for angles and stories. They've had a particularly good run of it, you know, in terms of the angles they've gone after. And I think if you watch a sort of a Lewis Goodall piece on it, for me journalistically, a couple of times we've sort of the next day have seen, well, actually, did you see that? Did you see the guest they had? And what's the trying to make that work in Wales? So yes, my downtime has been spent looking for new angles or new contributors to help tell the story. But also, I mean, I've got two small kids working from home most days of the week. My wife as well, a GP working from home. In terms of downtime, it's probably more like sort of upside down time, trying to keep everything together and keep everyone either happy or quiet or both in an ideal world.
Welcome to the episode. I'm sure we'll cover a lot of the stories or the potential stories that we may have put to the side or not given as much focus, possibly because of the health impact of COVID-19. Mm. But Phil, what about yourself? How are you keeping and what's kept you active during this period?
Well, you know, we've had a great deal to respond to with the emergency funding issues and the crisis for the arts sector. So there was a lot of work to do getting those programs together, those funding stabilization and emergency programs together. And obviously, you know, we have a lot of programs in the Arts Council which needed to be repurposed for this new period. This has been the work of our extraordinary executive team and staff. And I'm there in support and to chair council meetings. It's very interesting to chair council meetings of 20 people in these Zoom sessions. I'm too sharing the workspace here. In as much as my wife is running a project for Mind Cymru on social prescribing. For myself, I took some time to adapt because, of course, the interesting thing about my role as chair of the Arts Council, unlike being the chief executive, is that I have very, very busy weeks, but they're not routine weeks. There isn't a week that passes in which I don't do maybe 3 or 4 arts events, or in which I don't talk to government ministers and AMs about the arts and what's going on in their patch and about the funding issues, or in which I don't talk to local authorities or do media sessions. And these are, of course, diarized, but they're not routine meetings. And I suddenly found myself in this world in which the whole ad hocery of my life had disappeared. And I had to work quite hard to adjust to that. So when I was in a burst of activity and working on some policy or chairing a council, that was fine. But the normal run of things felt remarkably empty.
Ad hocery, I love that word.
Yes, I just made it up, yeah.
We'll coin that phrase and we'll keep it.
So it's fair to say that Wales is known for being the land of song, with a proud and powerful link to arts and culture that plays a big part of Welsh identity. I think before we get into the impact of COVID-19, why do you think arts and culture play such a big role here in Wales?
Well, I mean, first of all, it is deeply ingrained in our traditions. In the Welsh language, of course, the importance of certain kinds of music making, the importance of literature to a very broad public is absolutely crucial. But we've also had these extraordinarily powerful communities. So the performing traditions are rooted in Eisteddfodau, but they're also rooted in those incredible late 19th century communitarian movements in relation to brass bands, choirs, amateur operatics and dramatics. And those traditions are very powerful, and they have produced remarkable performers in both languages. When you talk to Daniel Evans, he'll talk to you about, you know, working in the local amateur operatic in the Park and Dare in Treorchy. And it's that kind of tradition which is so strong. One of the things that we're trying to do at the Arts Council, just to drift into policy for a moment, is to pursue very much an agenda of for the benefit of all. That's what our last five-year plan was called. And we're really aiming to broaden and widen the reach of the arts, because that's deep in our tradition. And what we need to do is to make sure that in communities that have seen huge social change and lost a lot of their economic power, or in the communities of Wales which are not defined by those traditional popular art forms, some of our extraordinary BAME communities and so on, with their own very distinctive arts achievements and forms, that we develop a much more inclusive world of Wales in the arts. So drawing on those great traditions, we seek to find a world of Wales through arts and culture, which is truly contemporary.
And Hugh, this episode will have come out after the Hay Festival, a Steddfod tea making its way onto the online world for the first time. And you've covered many of the arts and cultural events across Wales and further afield, some of which won't be happening in its traditional form in 2020. And yet these are events that, you know, bring people together. Why do you think arts and culture are so important, and what are we missing out on during 2020 in that regard?
I mean, I just think the physical event is such an important part of displaying Welsh culture, and they're a marker in people's years. They're where they go to see, you know, on the one hand, you hope they go to see high art and entertainment. On the other, you know, they're going to see their friends, and they're going to see their families and the people that they only may see at, you know, the Eisteddfod or the Royal Welsh even, or the Urdd. And for that reason, and Wales as a small country, I think needs those standout events to bring people together, as much as it needs that traditional, the oral storytelling culture and all the things which kept people in their homes sharing the best of Welsh tradition. But I think that's probably the biggest loss this year in terms of Welsh culture is the lack of those big events. And stream them if you can. It's certainly not the same. And I think the biggest challenge probably when we think that this year is a write-off in terms of those big events, is how do we make them come back next year, and for them to be held in a way which feels like we really miss them, we want to embrace them again, and that we hopefully next year can do that without too many restrictions. So nobody has, you know, is able to kind of forecast how well that will be able to happen next year. But, you know, the reason why things like Hay, the Eisteddfod are so important to people is because of all the things they get out of it beyond the planned program. And I think that's when you get through to that sort of the culture of Wales and the idea that you want to be there and embrace it, see it and hear it and feel it. And often it's as much about being there in the presence of it all as it is about sitting down and taking notes of what somebody's saying on stage.
So what Hugh says there about great festivals and great events is of course true of all the arts, of all the live arts, of, you know, the difference between going to see an exhibition online and going into an exhibition space and feeling that shared space around you and seeing the painting, the sculpture, the installation in a space. And obviously live theatre, live music, all these things are so different. We've learned a huge amount about what digital can do. We've learned a huge amount about how we can reach more widely, more inclusively through digital. And all the things we don't need to do, all those meetings we used to travel hundreds of miles for, which were so bad for the climate and the environment. But there's a lot we're learning from this and lots we can learn to do. But the shared encounter with art and the arts in a shared space is irreplaceable. And that's what we look for again. And as you said, it's writ large in festivals, in the milling throng, as you skip between the burger van and the ice cream store.
Oh, you never find me next to either of those stores, Phil.
I can see that.
I was somewhere else eating some salad in the corner somewhere. You anticipated the next question I had really about that translation of physical space to the online world. And, you know, one of the lessons, yes, you touched on inclusivity and accessibility, but, you know, I was very surprised actually last week in dropping into some of the elements of the programming of Hay, of that element of bringing the world to Wales, or at least showcasing Wales to audiences that may not have ever heard of Wales, let alone the Welsh language or the history behind different meanings. And I was watching Meredith Hopwood's session and seeing all the different countries looking in and taking part. There are a lot of lessons on there that we can keep and we should keep on doing after this. And maybe the accessibility, but it's interesting about the importance of the physical space as well.
I was talking today to some people working in our international division, Wales Arts International, and they're reflecting very hard on this. And it's been very interesting for them taking part in UNESCO sessions of the kind that we're doing now. And obviously, not large numbers of participants in terms of vocalizing, but people putting links and messages up on screen and so on. And it became even more clear to our staff and to Lynette Harve, who leads them, that there's so much that can be done now to project Wales in a much more distinctive way. It isn't just about making films showing a great performer, a great actor, setting them perhaps in a great landscape or reading some extraordinary poetry in a landscape. All those things that we do to promote the country through the arts and culture. But it's also now, she was reminding me today, and interesting talking to you, Jacob, about, you know, Wales is very distinctive future generations legislation. And that we've been developing a very distinctive practice in arts and health and well-being. And are seen to have some quite leading features in doing that. And now when we think internationally, we'll think differently about it. We won't just think about promos. We'll think about communicating the nature of our cultural achievement, the nature of what we care about, the nature of what's distinctive about us in a rounded social way, because we've been learning to do that. And I think it'll be a less narrow communication of Wales than we have sometimes attempted in the past.
I find the digital drive, I still greet every new announcement about a company putting their work digitally with a buzz of excitement and a slight kind of pang of, actually, I wish this wasn't on my laptop and I wish it was in a theatre. and you have to, you know, you applaud them for trying to get their work out there. But I do worry as well whether it has, in some cases, a damaging effect if the standard isn't good enough, if the web stream isn't high enough quality, if the user experience doesn't match what they've just had with Hay Festival, for example, who seem to do very well, versus other events and other streams I've tried to watch. As an audience member, you'll be rating these companies by how successfully they've mastered their digital offering during this this moment. And I worry slightly that from my own reactions, are other people who are chancing it on something they may not have ever seen in a traditional space, and they see a poor online version of it, which puts them off for longer than perhaps if they'd not seen it and chanced on it in a Stevod tent or whatever. But it's that for me is sort of the slight sort of quandary I have about the way that arts organizations have embraced digital, and also the way that some are always going to be able to do it better, and some, like, you know, the National Theatre in England have this back catalogue of productions that they can reel out every week and stick a donate button underneath and can get some revenue, some income, even though it's, you know, nowhere near what they would normally be getting at the box office. You expose those different structures and those the different different budgets essentially that organizations have had to either film their work in the past or to now try and film and share it with the world. So my sort of experience of that, of the digitization of those productions, has been a mixed one. I get these YouTube, I signed up to everything, I subscribed to all these channels, so I'm getting YouTube alerts every day about someone else going live or scheduling a performance. And there's one came today, and I thought, oh great, I'll watch that. And then I thought, oh, am I gonna actually watch it? Am I gonna get 10 minutes in and think I'm not laughing as hard as I did in the theater? As happened with One Man, Two Governors, when that came out on the web, I thought, oh, I remember roaring with laughter at this. And I sat there with someone who hadn't seen it in the theatre, did not think it was funny on YouTube. And I thought, oh gosh, maybe it is how much of that percentage of the enjoyment comes from being in the audience and having that communal experience as well.
Hugh makes a very powerful point. He makes a powerful point about things that don't live online, that do live in the shared space. And he makes a powerful point about the quality of capture as well, and that, you know, things have been well filmed or well recorded, and that the technology for delivery online is good and so on. All that's very true and very powerful, and we've got to be very careful about this. I think that where the arts may be coming alive more online is not so much in terms of capturing that complete performance, though that's certainly been the case where things have been brilliantly captured and there's a back catalogue. But often it's about the interactive. Often it's about the participatory. It's about those kind of activities that people can be brought into, and the shared exploration of a dance move, of a piece of writing and riffing on an idea. And those kind of things can be good.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important point. And, you know, behind that delivery and behind that interactivity, you have to remember that there's people. And, you know, arts and culture is such a huge industry. And while many organisations have been able to adapt, there are equally vast amounts of self-employed artists, performers and creators who really struggle through this time. And, you know, what has been the impact there? And has enough been done to support them? And, you know, going forward, do we have to think about better ways to support them so they don't have to face this problem again?
Well, if I may, I'll come in first there, because obviously the help to individuals has been central to the way we've designed our emergency response. But you make a very fair point here, and the fair point is that in some ways, the importance of that very large sector of artistic freelancers, people participating in the gig economy in many ways, has not been as visible in the past sometimes as it has been clearly visible to us now in this time of urgent need. I mean, you know, the Arts Council in the last 18 months prior to this crisis had dealt with over 400 individual artists with particular funding relationships. And obviously lots of individual artists get employed by the 67 organizations that we fund in our arts portfolio, who are the scaffold in the structure of the arts in Wales. So it's not that we're not engaged with individuals, but we become more strongly aware of them. And we were actually discovering more of them through our creative learning through the arts program. It's extraordinary. We thought we knew all the individual artists in Wales. And then suddenly through doing these projects with schools in localities around Wales, some extraordinary people were emerging with great capacity. So this urgent need has been borne in very strongly on us in this time of crisis.
Yeah, I suppose, Hugh, as a journalist covering arts and culture, you must kind of see a lot about the lived experiences of kind of people delivering arts and culture throughout Wales. What do you perceive as the impact being on them, I guess, and then kind of how do we manage this next going forward?
I mean, one of my biggest concern, I suppose, as somebody sort of just watching the way things work, is for those people who are early in their careers in the arts, who are perhaps not well established enough, or have, I don't know what, you know, in terms of the evidence for whatever whatever support is available, who may not have the paperwork, the accounts, the references, and who may be put off course now by this. I think there's probably a real risk that we will lose some really talented people who will go into other sectors, who will not get the nurturing, the encouragement that they need during this time. You think about the way that so many courses will be, university courses and FE courses will be coming to an end around this time. And there would be a whole host, you'd think, of graduates who would otherwise be getting their first jobs in whatever industry, whatever bit of the arts they were hoping for, who won't be getting that. And you have to think, well, the longer that the situation is a tough one, the more of those people we're going to lose. So that's the area which I think is very difficult to judge the impact, I suppose, until you're a couple of years into this. And then secondly, Phil was just hinting at the organisational support that's to come. And I would wonder, beyond the 60-odd revenue-funded organisations, what chance of anyone outside of that getting a slice of a small pie? But I'm not sure whether Phil's in a position to answer that yet. At this stage, it's not my turn to ask the questions.
Put him on the spot. No, I like that.
It just strikes me, Phil, that they would have first dibs and would expect first dibs as the organisations that have proven their ability to pay the bills, pay their artists, provide good programming as well.
Well, you'd be surprised. The Stabilisation Fund, obviously, you know, we'll be announcing in due course the decisions. We aim to get those decisions done 4 weeks after that original deadline, so it'll be, you know, 10 days into June. But actually a minority of the applications that we've had, of the 163, are from our revenue funded organizations. However, we set a maximum for the mainstream of these funds of £35,000. Now, that doesn't touch some of our most successful commercial venues, no, who are in our portfolio, and who have seen their income commercially disappear. And to take Hugh's other point, which was mixed in what he said, it's also the case that there are many organizations for whom this is open, who are people we often meet through lottery funding and who are not part of our portfolio, some of them festivals, other kinds of very important organizations in the art scene in Wales, who are precisely going to benefit from these applications. So the minority of them will be from our revenue funded portfolio, but we will have to struggle with this challenge of the scale of need from some of those revenue funded organizations. We're so large, significant, and have seen huge swathes of commercial income disappear. And that's why we need to keep talking to government in Westminster, but above all, in Cardiff.
And it's government in Cardiff has spent 10 years, frankly, telling the Arts Council to make sure these organizations have a diverse income stream and have got a good commercial revenue, and are now in a moment when all of that has dried up. But yep. Yeah, what do you think? I mean, does it sound to you like government, Welsh government, are prepared to help more, or understand the commercial impact?
I can honestly say that our dialogue with government ministers is very positive. I mean, I think, first of all, they've shown, and this isn't a plug, this is the nature of the dialogue, they've shown a great deal of appreciation for what we managed to do. And they, obviously, a large chunk of what we did came from our lottery funds, which we distribute. But there was also a chunk of our strategic funds, which they allowed us to use. And they came up with over $1 million themselves for the emergency funding. So we were able to put this $7.5 million together. They are talking to us all the time. Clearly, the organizations like Chapter, the Wales Millennium Centre Gallery, the context in which they operate is the UK government's context of furloughing and those kind of funding supports. So that context is important. There are many claims on the Welsh government's budget, and the emergency needs from many sectors are huge. But I think increasingly people have been coming to understand prior to this crisis, and now very sharply, about the importance of the arts and cultural activity for the well-being of the people of Wales, for social cohesion in communities, for economy, for the creative economy, but also just for sheer attracting of people into our cities and our towns from outside. And I think they understand that the well-being of our citizens and the things they enjoy and their health are deeply connected with these organizations. So I think we've been trying to win that argument more widely. For years, you've heard me say that the arts are not icing on the cake. They're not a nice to have extra in good times. They're crucial for the society and its economy and its future, and its health and well-being at all times. And that's been richly borne out by their importance, as has become apparent in crisis. So I'm hopeful, but who knows? These are tough times.
Thank you both. I'm very keen to understand the international world around us and how they're reacting within this space as well. There are a lot of international cultural activity that have been cancelled. We were lucky, I suppose, to get the Oscars in just before things turned south. But are there any other examples, maybe start with you, Hugh, about the impact on the international level and some of the... some of the action has been taken to help as well.
I mean, one of the first stories I was going to, one of the last stories I was going to do before I switched to covering health stories was to go to the London Book Fair, where Wales has a stall which it showcases the best of Welsh writing to the world. Incredibly important slot in a very big international marketplace, if you'd like, and that was cancelled, and it was probably at that point I realised where the trajectory of things. And just, I mean, Phil knows far more than I do about the international side of things, but we already know that, for instance, the Venice Biennale is not going to happen next year. It's been pushed a year later. There was a Welsh delegation in Dublin, I think, the week that the lockdowns were kicking in Ireland and here as well. So that work, which is culturally important, but is also diplomatically useful, I suppose, from a Welsh perspective, that isn't happening unless it's happening virtually, as it sounds like it is. But it's the loss of those opportunities to showcase Wales to the world, which are few, and which, if they are delayed by a year, means a year without it. And you sort of reassure yourself, or not reassure yourself, but you sort of think, well, fine, every country's in the same boat. every country is also having to adapt to this. But you do see a long list of cancelled international opportunities alongside those Welsh cultural events which have hit the skids as well.
Actually, here I was in Ireland that particular week, that, you know, the Welsh delegation were out there promoting the Welsh activity, and it did the interruption, the stop there. But Phil, you know, there are lots of countries who are having to adapt and change the way they're delivering programmes and services. I was quite actually thinking earlier around, I think it was the German culture minister who very early on in the pandemic made it clear that culture was going to be at the heart of their decision making. And we've seen, haven't we, in England recently, a culture commission or a culture task force being set up. What other examples are you aware of in the international space of, you know, people trying to learn to get to grips with what this challenge that they're facing?
Well, a lot of it is pretty much as Hugh described it, which is that, you know, great festivals, great international gatherings are working on this, and people are learning from each other. So if you have people like, you know, the people running our National Museum and Gallery in Wales, if you have people like the Tate in London and so on, these people are all seeking to learn internationally how we can move forward. They're seeking to learn how we can open up and in what ways, at what time. And obviously, you know, exhibition spaces will have some potential for doing this earlier than performing art spaces, with the way audiences are clustered and the way tickets are sold. So that kind of work is going on. He was right that the loss of international opportunities is very great. But one of the things that was happening before this crisis was that we were already having to consider how, in the face of that other existential crisis, the climate change crisis, we did our international work. We've been working for some time, as Hugh knows, on making sure that our work in Venice, our selection of our Venice artists, and our showing of their work, not just in Venice, but bringing the work back to Wales, was deeply rooted in Wales, and not just something that was showing our people internationally. But now we've started to think, well, can that place, Venice, which is so vulnerable ecologically and environmentally, can that place sustain this pressure in an ongoing way? And what's our responsible way of dealing with that? And so we were already evaluating that. You'll have to watch this space for our next approach to Venice. There's a paper being presented to council in July, and we've been thinking of ways of repurposing our approach, particularly in the light of what's going on now. But, you know, if I can also say, you know, encouragingly, I don't mean to be blithe, by the way. Just now we were talking about how, he was asking how optimistic I am about the level of government response. Let's be honest. We're talking about huge challenges. We're talking about a scale. The Wales Millennium Centre alone could lose 20 million of income if it can't open in a normal way till next summer or next spring. I mean, we're talking about massive sums. So nobody should underestimate, as Nick Capaldi, our chief executive, was saying to the Senate committee last week in an excellent presentation, nobody should underestimate the scale of this challenge. And the scale internationally for our work is massive. But we're working constantly on the link up. The link up with Ireland is constantly being worked at now. And internationally, we were doing great work with Japan. What you may not know, or your listeners and viewers may not know, is that Wales is seen internationally as at the cutting edge in terms of arts and health, and arts for mental health, and arts for dementia, and arts for older people. Hugh's reported on these things often. And we were already engaging with the Japanese on this, so we had a strong presence during the Rugby World Cup for arts and culture, but also for this arts and health work. And we'd had Japanese groups coming over to study us and the way that we do this. And there's a real opportunity for us in developing that agenda and providing services and insights and understandings. And that work is not ceasing, but we're having to find ways of creating continuity as we wait for the reopening of borders and societies and travel.
Great, and you mentioned earlier, Phil, actually, and it kind of goes back to what you've just said there. You mentioned about social prescribing, and you know, arts has a big role in that. And you know, we're seeing kind of different groups across Wales, whether it's singing for lung health groups, painting groups, dementia choirs, as you just mentioned. So how, you know, why aren't we seeing the backing from policymakers? How do we get them to support these programs, especially as we come out of this crisis now? It's going to be more important than ever.
Well, we've had some success in developing this agenda. So if you take the health sector, we've got a memorandum of understanding with the Welsh NHS Confederation. And that has led to a situation where we now have jointly funded with the health boards, Arts Council and Health Board, arts and health coordinators in each of those boards. And that is creating a much stronger dynamic of relationship between primary and secondary care, but primary particularly, and the arts and the arts sector. And so it's about knowledge, information, training. The artists have to get to know more and more what the needs are on the ground beyond their existing practice. Practice managers and GPs have to know what's available and have to enter into that kind of dialogue. I mentioned my wife earlier working with Mind Cymru in mental health on a social prescribing trial that they're running. And other groups are doing this. Just before the coronavirus hit, we were in a very productive dialogue with the chief medical officer, Frank Atherton, about this. And we said, look, you are probably 18 months away from having the architecture of social prescribing in place, ready to go with the learning from these various trials and pilots that have been developed. Give us some investment now for us to ready the art sector so that it's really strongly up and running for when that time comes. And Frank could see the case for that. And we were beginning that dialogue when the coronavirus pandemic hit. And all his attention, of course, goes in that way. But I take your point strongly, and I'm sure policymakers and funders do. And health officials do, that this pandemic has proven the urgent need for the kind of mental health support and well-being support that puts so much pressure on our surgeries and so much pressure on the lives of our citizens, and that the arts and other forms of social prescription can meet. So once again, the long trajectory we've been on for this should be assisted in some strange and awful way by what's been revealed in the present crisis.
Hugh, you know, you would have covered a lot of these social prescribing programs or been aware of them as an arts correspondent. You've now moved to the realm of health. That must be a surreal world of moving from one to the other, but there are those common things that have brought those two themes together. What do you make of all this?
I mean, it's why I've had an interest in covering it, really. One of the first things I did was a dance for Parkinson's story, which took me up to Bilth Wells, I think, in a small village hall there. And you know, filming it myself, no cameraman, but being able to be there for quite a long time to capture enough of that. Often we are restricted by only having a cameraman for an hour or an hour and a half, but I could be there for about the whole duration of the class before and after, to see the difference, the positive impact it was having on people who, you know, and there were all these stories that they normally wouldn't be able to get up and move about for very long, but actually these dance sessions got them limbered up and bouncing around the room. So it just sort of seeing it in practice led me to, I don't say I'm completely convinced by it, but obviously it's striking, the evidence is certainly there, and it's good to see that it's happening in lots of different ways in Wales, and that it, you know, Phil's not just saying it because he has to, it's true that it is taken seriously by the doctors as well as by the politicians, and clearly once, you know, the practitioners would like lots more investment and lots more opportunities to get it into those healthcare settings. But you know, anything from you know, we did something last year with actors reading to stroke patients in Llandoc. It's not just about dance classes or a sort of more artistic version of aerobics. It's about, you know, using the skills that these arts practitioners have, which have a real genuine health benefit.
It absolutely is, Hugh, and it is across a wide range of art forms. And I must say about dance, which is so important, that although it's the overlap with just getting active is huge, the dimension which is imaginative and expressive and emotive is a very crucial one. You know, and that's what distinguishes dance from other forms of just of mere physical activity. But we've got fantastic stories in Denbighshire, for example, of the visual arts being used to help people with dementia or with mental health difficulties. We've got great literature and writing work being done across a wide range of art forms, amongst young people and amongst the old. The range of what's been achieved is terrific. And we are past the point of having to prove impact. There's an amazing researcher at University College London who's done the key international work on this. And the impact studies now are just there. They're even there from 10 of us in terms of people's responsiveness to cancer treatment when they've been taking part in choirs. You know, it just, there are certain physiological dimensions that kick in. So I think we're now well established with the evidence for this. But what we have not got to yet is the investment that has to come from beyond the Arts Council, because it's of a scale that we can't cope with, although our commitment is solid. And this investment will deliver a prevention premium.
So, unfortunately, we are running out of time. I'm sure the conversation could go on for hours and hours on this topic. But if you had to put into one line, what would you like Wales post-COVID to look like in terms of arts and culture? Phil, if I could go to you first.
Well, we want Wales to have learned something massive from this crisis. And we want the whole of the arts sector to engage with a kind of systemic change, really. We laid it out in our big plan for the benefit of all. And people shouldn't be anxious about this. We want great art, we want excellence of all kinds, but we want everybody to work harder and harder, as they were already starting to and had been doing, to engage with the needs of a wide society, so that the arts are not the property of just a privileged few, but belong to everyone much more widely, and can transform lives much more widely. And we can see those lives reflected in the arts, because we've got to learn again to be a joined up society that cares for each other.
And Hugh, what about yourself? What's your hopes for Wales and arts and culture in Wales post-coronavirus?
I think it's going to be a case of learn from the best and hope for the best. I think, as Phil said, look at what's happening, who's doing well, how are they doing well, pick up those skills, pick up those opportunities where they do appear, and hope that you survive, and hope that when you come out the other end, audiences will return, that creative flair will be there, but also that arts organisations, who can sometimes be quite sort of siloed about the way they operate, can resist that urge during this and can look at, see what other sectors are doing, what other art forms are doing, to make sure they're keeping going as well as keeping their work on show.
I absolutely endorse that. We need as a sector to be well joined up. And there's lots of sign that people are doing that, because we need to be well connected with each other as artists and arts organizations to make the biggest impact that we possibly can. And Hugh is absolutely right. The final hope is that the art sector will be there, that it will have enough support to get through.
Thank you both so much for joining us. I think just the sheer amount of topics and issues that we've covered really do show how broad and how much of an impact the arts and culture sector has here in Wales. So thank you for guiding us through that exciting world.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm really pleased that we've decided to discuss arts and culture, because there's so much for us to discuss. I think the standouts for me from Phil and Hugh there, as well as learning a new word, ad hocery, something that I'm sure we'll try and squeeze into future episodes. But, you know, this is a real issue, and it's an issue that is not going to go away. The impact on the arts, the impact on individuals, the volunteers, the early practitioners, the point that he was making there around, you know, this is going to impact on those who are just about to enter into the arts and culture sectors, those who are looking to graduate this year, who are seeking job opportunities within the cultural sector, are not going to find those jobs there any longer. And the seriousness in Phil's message really around, you know, some of parts of this industry are not going to survive. And, you know, to hear this, the scary figures around the Wales Millennium Centre, you know, one of the main venues in terms of culture here in Wales, in our capital city, and the money that they're losing now and potentially could be losing over the next couple of months is quite scary.
Yeah, and I think what was very clear was that actually we don't give arts and culture the credit that it's due, and for the impact that it has and for the changes and the differences and the improvements it makes to people's lives. I think that was very clear. I think there does need to be more support there. And it's, you know, using levers like the Generations Act that will hopefully inspire us and enable us to do that better in a way that's sustainable as well. And, you know, and for me in particular, you know, I've worked with organisations that have delivered social prescribing programmes, and I've seen firsthand the impact that it has and the freedom and the power and the confidence that it gives people. And I think going forward, we really do have to see the investment in it. We can't keep investing in emergency spend. We can't keep throwing that money away when there are perfectly good programmes that can help prevent those situations in the first place. It's really important. I think if we can see the investment, and in a post-COVID world, you know, I think it's needed most. You know, people are going to be relying on these programmes, whether they've developed new lung diseases, whether they've been impacted through mental health, physical health. People are going to be relying on social programmes to get them through a very tough time ahead. So, yes, hopefully we see the investment, and hopefully the arts world will be able to come back from this and support that as well.
Absolutely. Well, that's all we've got time for on this slightly longer episode. Thank you so much to our guests. Best of luck with the week ahead. Stay safe, stay at home, and look out for each other.
Yes, thank you both, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this week's episode, make sure you rate and subscribe and join the conversation on our Twitter @curve_podcast using the hashtag flatten the curve podcast. We hope you join us next week as we continue our attempts to flatten the curve.